This is the first one with Captain Jack.
And gas mask zombies.
Creepy.
And an alien spaceship.
Tethered to Big Ben.
During the London Blitz.
It's called The Empty Child.
Here we go.
We're still on our endless voyage, all through time and all through space.
With Levine and Angels now, Dalek, Soilers, Zandun, wow.
Tennant, Smith and Eccleston, Gallifrey, where it all began.
Doctor Who is cool again, that was Russell's master plan.
Who back when? Reviewing all new Who there is. Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Rose and Donna, Amy Pond, Rory, Martha and beyond. Join us on this odyssey, what other choice could there be than Who back when? Who back when?
Welcome to N009 of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I'm JD, and joining me today is Ponkin.
What? Wait, what? That's me. Hi. How you doing, dude?
I'm fine. So today we're doing Empty Child, the first of a two-parter.
Wait, this is the first I'm hearing of this.
Well, this is going to be a fun episode then.
No. Yes, we are. Fantastic and double episode, by the way. Fantastic.
Well, considering our last double episode was...
Foreign aliens.
Aliens of London.
Yeah.
This only has to be better than Farting Aliens to be a good episode.
Oh, I completely disagree. Farting Aliens of London and World Farting 3, whatever it was, they were such incredibly bad episodes that even an incremental improvement does not guarantee goodness. You need to... what I'm trying to say is that they were well below par.
Well... For our listeners, let me put this into some sort of context about what we're about to listen to.
Okay.
This is a Hugo Award-winning two-parter.
Holy shit, I did not know that.
The Hugo Award is given to a variety of extraordinary science fiction and fantasy shows. Original Doctor Who never won it, but since Doctor Who returned in 2005... It has been won a number of times. This is the first time.
Was it also the first time that it was nominated for one? And also, how often are these given out?
It's a yearly award. It's the same as all of these sort of like, you know,
Oscars, Emmys, yeah.
So since 2005, it's been won for The Empty Child,
okay,
which is written by Stephen Moffat,
mm-hmm,
who obviously now runs Doctor Who. It was also won by Blink, which was written by Stephen Moffat.
Oh, I see a pattern here.
The Girl in the Fireplace.
Ah, who wrote that one?
Stephen Moffat.
Oh, I see. Okay. Do go on.
The Pandorica Opens.
Ah, okay. Can I guess?
Yes, go on.
Stephen Moffat?
Yes.
Bingo. Oh, the moth.
The Waters of Mars, which was written by Russell T. Davis.
Yes, that is true.
And The Doctor's Wife, which was written by Neil Gaiman.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So all of those have actually won the Hugo Award.
That's amazing. That's one a year?
Yes, with the exception of about 5 years ago, it didn't win, and Dr. Horrible's House of Terrible, or whatever that is, with Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, Nathan Fillion. Ugh.
Wait. What do you have against Nathan Fillion? Firefly, dude. He was awesome.
I hated Firefly and Serenity.
Really? Oh, I quite like both of them.
So apparently to most people.
Yeah.
But my other half watches Castle all the time, and okay, I can't watch it because it got him in it.
Does he only watch it because it's got Nathan Fillion in it, though?
No. We both like murder mysteries, and that's a murder mystery.
Okay, fair enough.
But sadly, I cannot watch it because he's in it, and I can't stand him. He's like my version of Catherine Tate is to you.
Okay, no, fair. Completely fair. I can relate to that.
And the other year it didn't win, it was won by Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay, also understandable.
So, this is, you know...
This is a step up for Doctor Who.
It's an amazing step up for Doctor Who. I don't think, you know, when Empty Child was done and it won it, you know, bear in mind, it's the first Hugo Award. It's the first, I think, award in general, which Doctor Who had ever won.
Wait, what? That can't be true. Surely. Doctor Who has been going forever.
Yes, but in the old days, you know, in the 1960s, children's science fiction on BBC One was never garnered
that kind of international attention either, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, when sort of like it came into the 80s and television science fiction was pretty much starting to get, you know, awareness in there, Doctor Who was a bit rubbish. You know.
Yeah. No, so, I do, sadly, I do know, yeah.
So
but we still love it. We still
Gordon Bennett, yes. You know, I wouldn't be here doing this, you know.
No, I was just saying that in case there was someone just about to turn off their iPod.
Oh, no, because 50, you know, we're in the 51st year of Doctor Who. And, you know, as probably doesn't come as a surprise to anyone that listened to this podcast, I've seen all of it. Many times,
yeah.
Even the 1980s. So,
I haven't yet. Yeah, I will.
No, so Empty Child is an award-winning episode. So that's you know, that's what we're about to review.
Yeah, exactly. That's really good. Keep people's expectations super high. Should we jump into a B scale?
Let's. The Doctor and Rose follow a threat-level MOVE metallic object through space and time to the London Blitz.
There they encounter two things. Number one, a creepy kid who sports a gas mask, thinks everybody's his mummy, and whom you should never touch because he'll make a gas mask literally grow out of your face.
And number two, Captain Jack Harkness, a temporal agent turned time-travelling con man who's all man.
Oh, yeah.
Sweeps Rose off her feet and who tries to sell the Doc and Rose the alien spacecraft.
And I wonder if numbers one and two are in any way connected.
You are welcome.
Bing bong, B-scow over.
Let's jump straight into the action with a cylinder, which is apparently threat-level MOVE, hurtling through the space-time continuum.
Yeah, I really like this tiny little conversation that they have about threat-level MOVE versus red being the standard warning colour. I thought it was pretty funny. It's like, oh no, red is considered to be kind of, is it camp? I think it's like, oh, red is always considered to be kind of camp, but mauve is like the most terrifying colour of all.
And, you know, you've got this mauve cylinder jumping the time tracks, making it difficult to lock onto, and about 30 seconds away from crashing down into London.
Yeah.
Here's a question.
Hit me. Oh my god, we're already into the skepticism zone. I love it. Okay, hit me.
No, it's not it's not skepticism at all, this one.
Oh, you're not going to ask me to, like, pronounce something, are you?
No. No, there isn't anything in this episode. I've got another one lined up for next season for you on that one.
Okay.
We know that jumping the time tracks is dangerous. When is the only other time it's been mentioned in Doctor Who?
Oh, wait.
And you do know it.
I do know it. It's Space Museum.
That is correct.
Bingo! Nice.
Gain one pumpkin point.
Oh, 10 points to Hufflepuff. I like it. Very good.
So that's why it's difficult to lock onto. Mm. So the TARDIS materializes basically in some sort of disused back alley.
Okay.
And the Doctor doesn't know whether it arrived earlier or it arrived later. So
exactly.
He's going to go and look for it.
Yeah.
Now, we get a lovely conversation with Rose and the Doc about, you know, Rose says, well, are you going to go and start scanning for alien technology? Which we'll come back to later.
Yeah.
And the Doctor says, well, no, I'm just going to go and talk to people.
Yeah, like something fell from the sky. People are going to have, they're going to have noticed it. And then we get the immediate, like, the immediate introduction of, hey, companion, stay here, I'll be right back, trope.
Yeah, and Rose says, well, that's not very Spock, is it? Thus actually cementing Star Trek as fictional in the Doctor Who universe.
That's very true. That is very true. By the way, you know that there's a Doctor Who Star Trek crossover, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's almost exactly what I was going to point out. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
What were you going to point out? What were you going to say?
That's a Doctor Who Star Trek Next Generation crossover.
Hmm. Bingo. Exactly. It's a graphic novel, I think.
In comic form. So pick up that graphic novel if you've not read it. So the Doctor psychic papers through to somewhere where he can hear a crowd, but Rose stays outside as on the rooftops of London, she hears someone calling for their mummy.
Oh, this is so creepy. The titular empty child wearing a freaking gas mask on a rooftop. He looks like he's going to jump. And Rose just is filled with maternal instincts. Goes, oh my goodness, I gotta go save this child. Runs off. Does not get the Doctor, by the way. Like, she doesn't stay with the TARDIS. She doesn't go get the Doctor and say, hey, Doc, listen, seriously, I'm trying to tell you there's a child on the rooftop. She just heads off on her own. Starts climbing this rope to get up to the child. But then it turns out the rope is attached to what, JD?
A barrage balloon.
That starts floating away.
At this point, Rose is on the end of a rope attached to a barrage balloon in the middle of the London Blitz wearing a Primark
Union Jack t-shirt.
This could not have been more British if they'd have painted, you know, some sort of target on her forehead.
She had been drunk watching the football and eating fish and chips at the same time.
Yeah, she picked the perfect time to wear this t-shirt.
By the way, when it starts off, this t-shirt is referred to as her new t-shirt. This is the first time she's wearing this t-shirt. It is her new t-shirt. Where did she get it?
She did a few episodes ago go back home.
Oh, you're right. She probably picked up some stuff.
Some new clothes.
Yeah, you're right.
Because her mum dropped off a load of washing.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway,
yeah, the
doctor is in some sort of, I want to say speakeasy, but it's not. It's exactly
what I was thinking.
It's a club. And basically the doctor, who doesn't know when he is temporally, quite blatantly, because he's in the middle of the Blitz, goes on stage and asks a load of people if they've seen anything falling from the sky recently.
Yeah, and is mistaken for a stand-up comedian, because this is obviously quite an absurd question to ask the crowd. Everyone just starts laughing, and then all of a sudden, kablamatron, the alarm goes off. The Blitz is afoot.
So the doc runs out of the club, going to go and find Rose, and basically he's back in the alleyway with the TARDIS.
Yeah. At which point?
He talks to a cat.
Okay, yeah, that's true. He does say hello to a cat. But I was going to say, at which point the phone in his TARDIS, which he says isn't actually a phone, but which later on in the series we've seen him use tons of times as an actual phone, it starts ringing.
Yeah, but up until this point, the doctor is right. It had never been used as a phone at all.
That's so weird to me.
Up until this point.
Okay.
But I have a bigger problem with this scene. Before we get on to the incredibly creepy thing coming up, I need to do the first of two or three World War II problems I have.
Oh, no. Okay.
One of my favourite times in history is World War II.
Okay.
And, you know, I have watched a number of programmes on the home front in World War II. And where the cat is sitting is a load of boxes that have been thrown out for rubbish. It's like a rubbish in the alleyway.
Oh, really? I made no note of it. I remember there being a cat, but that's it.
Yeah, and the cat was sitting on a load of discarded vegetables. Now,
discarded vegetables?
In World War II.
In London.
At the height of rationing.
Yeah.
That if someone had been stupid enough to discard the vegetables, which was punishable by time in prison.
Yeah, someone else would have eaten it already or taken it already.
Yes, and no one.
No one would fucking throw away vegetables. I don't even remember seeing this. This is crazy.
Yeah, it's where the cat was sat. It's why I noticed it. But not happening.
Classic
anyway.
Misdirection. I was just looking at the cat.
Yeah, when you should have been looking at the watermelon.
There's a joke in there I will not go into.
That's what she said.
Something, yeah. Okay, yeah, let's get into it.
Anyway, creepy teenage girl arrives in the alleyway and basically says, do not pick up the phone.
Yeah. The doc goes, why? And he's like, oh, no, it's not for you. It's like, yeah, but why? That's not even a phone, blah, blah, blah. He picks up the phone and it's the kid again on the phone this time going, are you my mummy? Yeah, where's my mummy? Are you my mummy? Can I come in now? And then the girl disappears, just as he's about to ask, like, yeah, well, seriously, what the hell? Who is this? How is he calling a phone that isn't a phone? She disappears, and he stalks after her. He hangs up, obviously, and he stalks after her.
What we then move on to is Nancy, the girl, who is a right little thief, goes into a house of some people who have gone into a shelter for, you know, to get away from the air raid.
Yeah.
So they've gone into their Anderson shelter and she goes into the house and starts stealing. And then we get an officers' club.
Yes. And this is fantastic. The lights are turned on. There's music on. These officers are drinking cocktails. It seems as though they're just... It seems as though it's a window into the roaring 20s during the London Blitz of 41. They seem blissfully unaffected by this.
Oddly enough, this is my second bit.
Okay, here we go.
So, number one.
Yeah, you turn on the lights and they're going to see exactly where you are and so on.
In the middle of the Blitz,
yeah,
you don't have the curtains open. with the lights on.
Obviously not.
Very well lit room. These people are RAF officers and army. We felt because one of the people in there was an army guy.
Yeah.
They would not do that in any stretch of the imagination. Not only that, this has been a few minutes since the alarms have sounded, and they're still sitting around drinking and smoking. And
yeah, no looking. One's getting into an airplane or manning a cannon or anything. These guys are just like, ah, fuck it, let's just have some fun.
It is the most laissez-faire wartime officers that are possible.
Now, you know what this is? This goes hand in hand with World War III. This goes hand in hand with everything we've seen so far on the revival of Doctor Who, because every single time that you have anyone who is in uniform, if they are be they a policeman or a soldier or a security guard or a unit troop, they are always going to be absolutely shit at their job. They will never do anything in terms of security. They will never do anything in terms of discipline and regime. They have no order and no organizational skills.
They can't write military. That's what I've taken away so far. But anyway,
I think it's meant to be kind of a caricature. That's what I took from it, because obviously it's unrealistic. I mean, I can only think of one situation. We're coming up to it very soon, but there's one situation where the lights are turned on and something else is around that is fucking so incredibly blatantly in everyone's face that obviously would never happen. Coming up in this again.
Oh, yes. That is third rant.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But anyway, one of these one of these people is a guy in an RAF coat who's actually American.
Yeah.
And who is looking at Rose's backside and breasts via a set of advanced binoculars.
Digital binoculars. Yeah, exactly. Hey, correct me if I'm wrong. When he first... he's addressed by one of the other, actual English chaps. When he's addressed by him, does he respond with a fake English accent?
No.
He doesn't. All right. Okay. Because anyway, he then says something like, oh, nice butt, nice bottom, or something in his American accent. The other chap thinks that he's talking to him. And then, bada bing, bada boom, he's off to, one presumes, rescue Rose.
He's played by John Barrowman, who, at the time, was not exactly very well known. He'd done some theatre stuff, and TV, but he wasn't well known. But soon, John Barrowman will be fucking everywhere.
Yep, he will. You say, I don't know how to interpret your facial expression. You say this as though it's not necessarily the good thing.
Barrowman!
Are you not a fan?
It's fine until he's literally everywhere you turn on television.
Really? Wait, what else has he done except Torchwood?
Desperate Housewives, Arrow. Arrow. He's the main bad guy in Arrow.
Oh, really? I've never seen that.
Oh no, he gets everywhere. He is literally I was gonna say omnipotent. That's not quite the right word. He is omnipresent.
Bingo.
On television. Anyway, Rose falls off her barrage balloon.
Yeah, and is caught in what is actually later on referred to as a tractor beam, which is the Star Trek term for said device.
It is, and
yeah, there you go.
Does what it says on the tin, and basically, after some flirting while in the tractor beam, he pulls her into his ship.
Yeah, he pulls Rose and catches her in his arms. She faints. He's dashing. He finds her very attractive. This can only end well.
So we then go over to the girl, the thief, that we met earlier, who we find out is called Nancy, and she brings in a whole load of homeless children in to eat the masses and masses and masses of food left behind by this three-person family.
Yeah, insane amounts of food. Truly insane.
I will revisit this later, but the masses of food is given an explanation.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
Thankfully, otherwise it would have been completely unrealistic. But even with the explanation that we are given, there is too much food here.
Yeah, there's too much food even during peacetime. As in, if this had been going on during peacetime, this would have been an enormous feast.
Yeah, exactly. And outside the front, this guy has, a flag. He seems to be, in his scenes that he's in, the guy that owns the house, quite patriotic.
Yeah.
a patriot, no matter what, would not waste this amount of food.
Yeah.
Because irrespective...
They're a family of three, right?
Three.
Yeah. They have one child. He's there, his wife's there, they have one daughter or one son or whatever it is. And they have enough food to feed, I don't know, well, how many kids are in there now?
How many kids are in there now is maybe about 10 to 12, but...
Yeah, 10 to 12, and they are having way more than they need in order to survive. You could probably get 100 people through the night with what they have in that room.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say that that's not too much of an exaggeration at all.
Yeah.
And he seems to be a bit of a patriot. And I don't think it makes much sense that someone who would do that, they would cook more than they should, but they wouldn't waste food. That's just not silly. Anyway,
yeah.
The homeless people are here.
Bingo.
And then the doctor magically turns up.
Yeah, he's there at the table. He starts eating with them, essentially, or at least starts serving himself. And he asks the kids, have they seen something fall from the sky? Here, let me draw it for you. And he produces a sketch of this cylinder that is so poorly drawn that no one, not even a child with its incredibly vivid imagination, could possibly conceive what the doctor intends with it. Doesn't matter, though.
No.
There's no time to get a response because all of a sudden there's a knocking on the door, and guess who it is? It's Gas Mask Dude.
Yeah, but just before the Gas Mask Dude turns up, the entire scene with Nancy and the Doctor, is it just me, or do you honestly think that she would have made a really good companion?
I think she would, because she's incredibly precocious. Well okay, she is incredibly precocious because it turns out, spoiler alert, she's actually much older than she looks, and she's practically a grown-up. But at the moment, especially in this scene, I think the bonus to their dynamic is that you kind of assume her to be just a child, but she acts and sounds and thinks like an adult, and is very generous, and thinks only of others, or at least of others before herself. Yeah, she would make a great companion. She's adventurous, and she's a good soul. She's a mensch.
Yeah, she is. But she's got great chemistry with Eccleston.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. There's that sort of positive antagonism in that scene that they have.
So, the gas mask is at the door. Nancy is terrified.
Yeah. Gets all the kids out the back door.
And the doctor's going, well, why? Why? What's the problem? And then Nancy says, well, it's not an ordinary child. He's empty.
Yeah.
Telephone rings. The doctor picks it up, and it's, are you my mummy?
Yeah, the voice turns up on the radio. Then the voice turns up, wait for it, in one of those, the gorilla equivalent of the Duracell bunny. It's a little monkey toy with cymbals.
The clapping monkey.
Yeah. It has no speakers. How can it produce a voice?
Well, I was going to say, let's put a pin in this.
Okay, all right, fine. Yeah, no, you're right. Let's put a pin in this because we're going to get an explanation of it later on that makes no fucking sense for this goddamn gorilla bunny.
No, exactly.
I'm so pissed off right now.
I'm with you on this. What's actually weirdly is we've made exactly the same notes for this episode. So
bingo!
This is quite good for us.
Yeah, great minds think alike. I like it. Okay.
Anyway, so the doctor goes to go and let the child in. Nancy runs off.
Yeah.
But...
This is so weird, by the way.
The street is empty.
And when this... that's what it should have been called, the empty street. When he went to the door to open... He goes, all right, I'll open the door, I'll let you in. The little boy pulls his hand back in through the postbox, and he opens the door, and the kid is not there. I was so freaked out at the time when I was watching this. I was so freaking scared. It was... Like, the best effect that you could achieve through a proper high-profile horror film was in this tiny little scene. This child is so creepy. Anyway, let's move on. Yeah.
So, we now go back to the Pleasure Palace ship.
Yep. It is actually sort of a Lilliputian version of Jabba's barge, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm surprised that Rose doesn't wake up, like, regain consciousness wearing a bikini.
Yes, that does actually... It's very... For those that have seen it recently, this is almost very Guardians of the Galaxy sort of...
Oh, I haven't seen that.
...esque. So it's very Guardians of the Galaxy-esque at this point.
Yeah? Oh, I cannot wait to see that.
So...
Anyway, she wakes up there. Go for it.
And Captain Jack puts his psychic paper out...
Yeah.
...and introduces himself.
Yeah.
Rose is psychically papered and realises what it is and goes, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you got a cup of tea there?
I do have a cup of tea. It's empty.
Okay, sit back for this one.
Okay.
First of all, he introduces himself as a member of 133 Squadron. Now, 133 Squadron was a set of American volunteers that it was a squadron of American volunteers in World War II.
With the RAF.
With the RAF.
Yeah.
Perfectly correct. Sadly, it wasn't actually formed until quite a few months after the Blitz. So it can't exist at this time. But, you know.
I think it's still A for effort.
A for effort. And sadly, this is where it all goes a bit wrong. He introduces himself as Captain Jack Harkness.
Yeah.
Which has some logical flaws. So I checked with a few friends of mine.
Okay.
And I will name check them because one of them at least listen to the podcast. So that's Ryan Jones, Virginia Wynne Jones, and Stuart Williams.
Hello, all of you.
Hello, all three.
How are you doing?
So, first of all, Harkness isn't wearing the stripes of a group captain. He's wearing the stripes of a squadron leader. Irrespective of that, group captain isn't abbreviated to captain. The RAF don't actually have captain as a rank. If he's aiming for American, which contradicts what Algy said in the earlier scene about you RAF chappies, they do have a captain, but he's not wearing those stripes either, because a US captain is actually the equivalent to a flight lieutenant. So whichever way you cut it, his uniform is fucking annoying. But I would forgive that if he hadn't been hanging around with Army and RAF people who would have pointed this all out to him. So if it was just like, you know, he's from the future, he doesn't quite know, makes perfect sense.
Okay, that is very true. I think maybe there are two things that need to be taken into account here, and one of them I'm not at all sure about.
Before you move on.
Yeah.
In Torchwood.
Yes, this is going to be my point number two.
They update his costume to be wearing group captain stripes.
Oh, really?
Yes, because they must have known it was an error in this episode.
Oh, okay. In that case, there's genuinely nothing I can say, except that a moment ago, he and the RAF chappies were having cocktails while vinyls were blasting through the open lit windows during an air raid.
Oh, and if you
some missing stripes here and there between friends. Well, yeah, what's that? That's nothing.
Oh,
come on.
It gets worse because soon we'll get to the point where we both want to complain about.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh no, seriously. This is one thing at a time.
So Jack heals Rose's hand with a cloud of nanogenes.
Yeah. Oh, wait, hang on. Can we... Really, really sorry. Can we rewind one tiny little step? Because I have a question about the psychic paper, and I have a feeling that there's no better person to answer it than you.
Go on.
Okay. How does psychic paper actually work? Because I was under the impression that it was, if not a collaboration between the person whose paper it is and the person looking at it, it was probably focusing on the person looking at it. So if I saw, if you held up psychic paper to me and I expected you to be my commanding officer, then I would see there whatever it was that states that I am your, that you are my commanding officer. But in this scene, it seems as though it's his mind that directs his psychic paper. And that makes very little sense to me. I think there are scenes later on in Doctor Who where he has no idea what to introduce himself as. He just flashes the psychic paper. People look at it and they go, oh, of course, come right through. But he has no idea what to say, right?
Yeah, that happens in The Idiot's Lantern.
Bingo. So that means the power of what is actually projected on there is in, like, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The ID is in the eye of the beholder, so to speak.
Although, what he is doing is he's showing the psychic paper and saying, I am Captain Jack Harkness of 133 Squadron.
Yeah.
So that person is expecting to see an ID card of Jack Harkness of 133 Squadron.
Yeah, but in that scene, they also use the psychic paper as a means of flirting with each other, because they go like, yeah, actually, now your paper isn't saying that you're Jack Harkness, it's saying that you're single and you like long walks on the beach and you're a Pisces.
Yeah,
like, that sort of thing.
Well, no, yeah. I can vaguely understand the bit where he's trying to use it as an ID card.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the next bit,
okay,
which is the flirting with the psychic paper,
yeah,
I can't justify at all.
Maybe they just hadn't really worked out psychic paper yet. I think, fine, canonically it may not work. Maybe this is an anomaly. Like, maybe this just is where psychic paper failed logically. But as a plot device just to get them flirting, I like it. I think it's really funny. I like this scene.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong. The scene is great. And apparently, Rose has a boyfriend called Mickey Smith, but considers herself footloose and fancy-free.
Yeah.
And in her words, available.
Yes.
Very available.
Well, you know what? F yes. God damn it, Rose. I can't believe she still feels that she's somehow tethered to the incredible, dismal weight that is Mickey Ricky. Oh.
So anyway, Captain Jack invites her out onto the balcony.
Yeah.
Where's this balcony?
So okay, so let's see here. Pretty sure, maybe I can't remember if you or I mentioned this in the introduction, but so it's this invisible spaceship that he's flying around in, and it's tethered to Big Ben. And Big Ben is all lit up, by the way. And he turns off the invisibility. Oh, no, sorry, you're right. It's not lit up. It's not lit up, not yet.
No, Big Ben's in, like, standby mode at the
okay,
moment.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, it's on standby mode. But they are now standing on top of the outer hull of his invisible or his cloaked spaceship. She goes, holy fuck, I'm standing on something, but I don't know what it is. And he goes, oh, don't worry about it. I know there are freaking Nazis all over the place, and I know that there's an errand, and I know that people are watching the skies, and I know that it's nighttime, and that anything bright is going to fucking, like, be a goddamn neon sign saying, check me out, I'm different. But I'm just going to press this button and uncloak my goddamn spaceship. And
Barrowman,
what are you doing? All of a sudden, this huge, awesome looking, mind you, but still huge, quite, you know, not exactly inconspicuous spaceship materializes out of nowhere in 1941 next to Big Ben. Everyone's gonna see it. And by the way, when he caught her in the tractor beam, that's, I think that goes hand in hand with this. There was a freaking massive beam holding onto a woman in midair during an air raid. Presumably, quite a few people are looking at the sky at this point, right?
So, for a few seconds, before we get to the next bit of Barrowman malarkey.
Oh, God damn it.
Right?
Yeah.
We move to Nancy and the Doctor.
Okay, all right.
And so at the moment, we have Rose and Jack flirting and being funny. And meanwhile, we have this absolutely terrifying story going on.
Yeah.
And it really is swapping between these two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and it's done very well.
So Nancy and the Doc, basically, the Doc follows Nancy to where she lives, which is in a railway siding.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically wants to know more about the child. And Nancy gives some exposition of that, yeah, she knows what the cylinder was. She knows where the cylinder was. It fell on the other side of Limehouse. It's being guarded by the military. And frankly, if you want to know what's going on, you'll have to go and speak to the Doctor.
Ooh, and Eccleston has a great look on his face when he hears these. He's like, well, what? Wait, what? Wait, there's someone else who calls himself that?
So, meanwhile, after those few seconds of plot,
yeah,
Rose and Barrowman are on top of the now visible spaceship.
Yeah, which no one has noticed.
The Moonlight Serenade playing, dancing with her, drinking champagne.
Yep.
He reveals at this point that he is a time agent.
No, that he was one.
He was a time agent.
Yeah. Now, and he thinks that Rose is a time agent.
Correct. Time agents have been in Doctor Who before, once.
Okay, when?
What, Tom Baker.
Really?
Yeah, it was in an episode called The Talons of Weng Chiang.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When Magnus Greel basically thinks the Doctor is a time agent from the 51st century. So let's put a pin in that one.
Okay, pinned. Turns out he has Barrowman now. So back on the floating flirt ship, Barrowman, turns out, has a deal to make, or he proposes to make a deal with the time agents. He has a fully equipped, he says, Chula warship that he is prepared to sell to the time agents. And it's somewhere in the city, somewhere in London, and it's going to be bombed. Like, it's somewhere where he knows a German bomb will land in 2 hours' time, I think. And that's essentially the duration of the deal. Like, if they want to buy this bomb, this spaceship, they've got 2 hours to do it before it gets bombed to shit. I've got a couple of questions for you. Numero uno, have we ever encountered Chula before?
No, but it's the name of an Indian restaurant in London.
Oh, very nice. Okay. And number two, what exactly are space agents meant, or sorry, time agents meant to do here? Like, are they interested in the spaceship, this warship, because it's anachronistic and they want to clean up the timeline? Or...
Yeah, they're like time police.
Okay. Well, so does that mean in this case that, oh, well, if it does get bombed by German, by in the air raids, then the splinters of this thing will still cause massive anachronistic detriments?
Possibly that bit doesn't make any sense. And in a way, it doesn't make much sense for a reason, because we find out that later on that most of the stuff that comes out of Captain Jack's mouth is bollocks.
Yeah, that's true. But he has done, he has performed this con on many an occasion, right?
Yes, but we don't know how many times it's actually been successful.
Okay, that is true.
Anyway,
yeah.
Barrowman and Rose Tyler are on top of the invisible spaceship, visible spaceship.
Yeah.
But obviously the moonlight serenade and the champagne and the flirting is, you know, not 100% perfect. It's 95% perfect right now, but he wants to get to 100%. So what exactly does he do in the middle of the blitz?
Well, Rose wants to know what time it is. And thus, he presses a button and he turns on Big Ben.
All the lights come up. Big Ben goes bong.
Oh, I'm so angry with this scene. It infuriates me. It infuriates me. There are freaking planes everywhere. You want to be somewhere hiding in the dark. And if you've got this F-off goddamn spaceship in the middle of London in 1941, a spaceship that clearly does not belong there, and it's parked next to something that can shine light, apparently, then maybe keep that goddamn light turned off. So now they've turned on the... Oh, sorry. I'm so angry right now. 78% of all the light emanating from London is emanating from Big Ben right next to them.
Which is doing two things. Number one, summoning all the Germans in the known world,
yeah,
right, as an invitation to shoot this thing.
Yeah.
Oh, here's London. Oh, here, please shoot me. Oh, and number two, it's illuminating Barrowman and Rose.
Yeah.
Oh, and the big spaceship.
And the spaceship. That's what I'm thinking. That's the goddamn biggest freaking plot hole here.
Oh, Barrowman! Anyway, back with the plot.
Yes.
Nancy and the Doc.
Well, have they not parted ways now? Maybe not, sorry.
She says, go to the hospital, you're right, and she goes off to, as we'll find out, steal more things, and she does give the Doctor another piece of information before she leaves.
Yes,
which
you're
was
right.
Her brother, Jamie, was killed in an air raid the night the cylinder fell.
Yeah.
Which, of course, won't come back to haunt us.
No, not at all. It's pretty obvious. On the other hand, like, I don't know if it's clunky writing or if it honestly couldn't have been done in any other way. It's just very, very obvious that the boy, Jamie, is the boy with the gas mask.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so she walks away. If I'm not mistaken, Jamie actually follows her at this point. And... the Doctor goes to which hospital, JD?
Albion Hospital.
Which we encountered.
In Farting Aliens of London.
Yes, one and two.
That's where the space pig was.
Yeah, very true.
Which was easily the best bit of Aliens of London, so... So the Doctor arrives at Albion Hospital and starts going through all the wards. And all of the bodies he finds are wearing gas masks.
Yeah.
And he's just walking through this very dark, darkly lit. This hospital's lit correctly for the Blitz, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, it's very dark. It's, you know, it's quite blacked out. And he then meets a doctor, Dr. Constantine.
Yeah.
Who's played by Richard Wilson.
Ooh.
Richard Wilson is... one of these, British comedic actors, he played the main character in One Foot in the Grave, which was probably his most famous role in recent times.
Does he have another Doctor Who connection?
No.
Okay.
Sadly.
He's very charming in this.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he's playing a very old and weary Doctor. And he says, well, none of these people are actually wearing gas masks. And, you know, he says, go and examine them. And the Doctor sonics them. So apparently the sonic can also be used as a tricorder.
Yeah.
And he discovers that all of them have identical wounds. So identical head injuries,
chest injuries,
a scar on the back of the hand, and the gas mask is actually fused to the face.
Yeah, with no visible scarring. It's just part of them. And the doctor actually says, not the doctor as in Eccleston, but doctor as in white lab coat, actually says, injuries as plague.
Yes, and that is quite a nice sort of emotive way of describing it.
It really is.
And then we get a really lovely bit where Constantine states that basically he lost his family in the war, and all he does now is he cares for his patients.
Mm.
The doctor and Constantine empathize over the fact that before the war, they were both fathers and grandfathers, which is a touch of, you know, the thread that runs right the way through, sort of like Eccleston and Tennant of, you know,
having lost everything
about the Time War, and, you know, that he's probably lost Susan in the Time War, somehow.
No, that's very true.
So yeah, Constantine is great in this. So he tells the doctor to go and visit this room where they basically took the first patient, the only one that actually died in the night of that air raid.
Yeah.
And
well, he's saying this, he looks at his own hand and he sees that he has the same scar on the back of it. And the reason he's volunteering all this information all of a sudden to a complete stranger is because he knows he's done for. And as he says, listen, that's the room, that's where it is, that's patient zero is in that room, I'm going to go, I'm going to die now. And then all of a sudden, his words start changing, and his voice starts changing, and it is creepy as hell. All of a sudden, he asks Eccleston, are you my mummy? And out of his face, I'm not speeding now, right? This is happening right now.
No. This is perfect. And yeah. It's creepy as hell.
It's so creepy. Oh, this old man who starts talking like a child all of a sudden out of nowhere, going from perfectly intelligible to just childish and scary. Out of his face grows, out of his mouth grows a gas mask and envelops his face. And all of a sudden, there he is. And all of them, at this point, I think everyone's sat up in bed as well, just looking at the doctor. Oh, okay, all right. Oh, and we've also now learned the number one rule from Lab Coat Doctor, and that is, do not touch the flesh. If you touch the flesh, you will become like them.
And the special effect here of the gas mask coming out of the face is brilliantly done.
Yeah.
This is an episode. This is right, and there's been a lot of discussion over the years of when is best in the year for Doctor Who to be on.
Mm-hmm.
This is an episode that needs to be done in winter, with it being dark outside and you're watching this. This is an episode to watch in the dark.
Yeah.
Because it is very creepy.
Yeah.
As a nice doctor sort of sits in his chair and becoming a gas mask zombie, Barrowman and Rose appear.
Yeah.
And Rose tries to explain to the doctor about Barrowman's plotline.
Yeah.
But the doctor doesn't care about Barrowman's plotline, and neither do we.
But we will learn very shortly that the two plots are connected.
Correct. But at this moment, we just want Barrowman to shut up so we can get on with the really creepy, evil.
Yeah, exactly. Kid. Exactly.
But anyway, the only important bit of Barrowman's exposition here is that the ship which he's trying to sail isn't a warship, it's actually an ambulance.
Yeah. It's very strange, actually, how quickly he reveals this. He doesn't actually have to say anything. It would be perfectly fine for him to say, listen, no, I scanned it, it is safe, don't worry about it, it's just a whatever. But all of a sudden he just goes, listen, I was trying to con you, it's not a spaceship, it's not a warship, it's an ambulance, and yeah, they have ambulances in wartime too. And, alright, okay, fine, so we get that.
So, we then cut to Nancy,
yep,
who has gone back to the same house as she was in before.
Yep.
And as she enters into the living room or the eating area, the dining room, basically all the devices come on again. And the Are You My Mummy starts up and, you know, let me in. Nancy hides.
Mm-hmm.
And as she tries to run away, the child basically...
Like telekinetically.
Telekinetically, which makes no sense later on. It's clapping monkey all over again.
Yeah.
Pin in this. See you next episode.
Yeah.
So, basically, Nancy is being threatened by the empty child, and then we find out the empty child is Jamie, as if we hadn't guessed by this point.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the hospital, all of the patients zombie-like, sort of Walking Dead-esque.
Yeah, start approaching.
Backing the Dark Rose and Barrowman into
a corner, yeah.
And that is the end of the episode.
Cliffhanger. That is awesome. Okay, I am psyched. That is such a fantastically tense moment to end the episode on.
Absolutely, it's a great bit, and I know we've complained a lot during the episode, but it's a good story, and it's very creepy.
Yeah.
So, reviews.
Reviews. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, first off, really have to say this. I don't know at what point in space-time you're listening to this episode of Who Back When, but immediately after finishing this recording, we will also be recording the follow-up episode, as in part two of this double feature. So if that is available as well, consider that maybe part of the opinion of this episode will also be maybe revised or expanded upon in the next one. That being said, The Empty Child is a fantastically well-done and well-crafted horror story. It takes us back to Earth for the nth time, not just Earth, but England, and not just England, but London. But not just that, it also takes us back to the Blitz, which is a part of London history that we have and or will visit on a number of occasions. We've even seen it in audiobook form, or heard it in audiobook form, rather, in Dead London. So it already feels very Doctor Who-y. Add to that, you've got the sci-fi element, you've got the horror element, you have, anachronisms aside, you have the historical elements. This is very well crafted, and it's well written. I don't find Barrowman all over the place because I don't watch Arrow and, what was the other one, Desperate Housewives? Jesus Christ, JD, I can't believe you watched that. But that, because of that, maybe, I love him. I think he is awesome, and I cannot get enough of him. I think Captain Jack is a fantastically charming character. In this case, this is his pilot episode, so to speak, no pun intended. But he is maybe a little bit too cheesy and greasy, but that's okay. I love him as a character. I have not given any thought at all what score to give this. I have to mark down, as I have done before, even in the fantastic episodes like Dalek or Father's Day, I have to mark down for the plot holes and the illogical aspects of the show. So obviously, Big Ben, spaceship in the middle of a London Blitz. Actually don't really mind the RAF chaps having their cocktail session. I thought that was kind of funny as a caricature. Without all those negative aspects, I would probably give this a 4.8, but because of them, I'm taking this down to a 4.5. Empty Child gets a 4.5.
Okay, so I'll start off with the negative points.
Okay.
The London Blitz anachronism and Barrowman's inability to wear the right uniform.
Okay.
I don't think I could knock many points off for that. So I'll start this one out as a 5 mm-hmm. and take it down to a 4.9 for those bits.
Mm-hmm.
What other bits didn't I like in this episode?
Big Ben.
Okay, Big Ben being lit up, just completely nonsensical at this point. It goes mm-hmm. down to a 4.8.
Yeah. Holy shit, I forgot about the monkey.
The monkey takes it down. Well, the monkey and the telekinetic door take it down to a 4.7. Yeah. But, you know, ultimately, 51st century, which I'll come on to in the next episode, and time agents being uttered in the same breath, which is the right century for a time agent,
mm-hmm.
and Stephen Moffat must therefore have watched Talents of Weng Chiang to get that right,
yeah.
because that would be too big of a coincidence. I'm giving Empty Child, because it is so darned creepy, and with the exception of Dalek, there is nothing to compare it to this season. It's a 4.8.
4.8. Nice. Listener. And it is review time. And this one comes from Stephen. Stephen says, to date, I have only been reviewing Hartnell episodes, but I wanted to make sure I got in a review for this particular two-parter. Mostly because I had a personal story about when I was first getting into Doctor Who that I wanted to share.
I originally got interested in Doctor Who about 2 years ago. It was summer, and I was helping with watching my nieces, aged 9 to 12 at the time, during the school break. I wanted to find something to watch that I would enjoy without having to worry whether or not they might walk into the room and see something overly violent or frightening. I'd seen multiple references to Doctor Who and thought I'd give it a whirl, starting with Eccleston's episodes. As you can probably see coming from the moment I worried about anything overly violent or frightening, that plan got shot straight to hell with the four magic words, "Are you my mummy?"
Yes, I can see that happening. He goes on, "Moving on, in this tale, the Doctor learns that Blitzkrieg London is perhaps not the best place to ask if something has fallen from the sky. The mystery dials are cranked up high and quick, as both Rose and Doctor have encounters with strange individuals. Rose and the boy in the gas mask, the Doctor and the disappearing girl. Rose also meets the one, the only, the omnisexual Captain Jack Harkness, whose first words, 'excellent bottom,' as he stares at Rose through high-tech binoculars, tell you everything you need to know about him in mere seconds."
I liked that the Doctor and Rose are separated very early on, and both find their own ways to investigate the mystery. Amusingly, Rose gets to do all the Spock stuff she wants alongside Jack, learning just what they were chasing. Meanwhile, the Doctor is doing classic detective legwork, befriending the locals, and finding where their goal is actually located.
That's a really good point. Stephen goes on, "The creepy levels are maxed out as quickly as the mystery levels. The, quote-unquote, empty child and the constant asking for mummy hits one a few different ways. A lost child looking for his mother is already one of the most potent emotional buttons that can be pressed. Put that in combination of the gloomy atmosphere and the faceless look the child has with the gas mask, and it's easy to see why the empty child is among the creepier creatures in modern Doctor Who."
Much like Captain Jack, you learn a lot about the Doctor. When faced with this potential abomination to all things living, the Doctor's first impulse is to sit down and try to talk to and empathize with it.
The CGI when Dr. Constantine transformed was a bit too obvious for my liking. I've said before, I'm forgiving about the special effects with classic episodes. I'm a bit less so with modern effects. That's mostly because I tend to look at old sci-fi special effects with the knowledge that at some point they were really cutting edge. And even if they weren't, I take the view that if they weren't bad then, how good would they be now? To a point that does also apply here, as there is a generally strong difference in effects from Eccleston's era, when New Who was starting out, to Matt Smith's, when it's much more popular and presumably getting a bit more budget. That said, while I wasn't a fan of the transformation in general, the point where the eyes bud out into gas mask lenses was suitably freaky, in part because of the obvious CGI effect. I thought it was really creepy in general, to be honest.
For rating, I'm giving The Empty Child a 4.1. Like any good two-parter, it sets up a compelling mystery to be resolved in part two. While a serious episode, I like the humour that got mixed in, the universal mauve alerts, the Doctor popping up in the middle of the dinner thievery, much of Captain Jack in general. It loses some points for the CGI effects, but not really enough to hurt its rating.
Thank you very much for that review.
Thank you very much. So you gave it a 4.1. So we're all in the 4 sort of zone. And thank you for sharing the first time that you got into Doctor Who with us.
Yeah. did your nieces actually get to see a part of this double feature? Holy crap. They must be traumatized. I'm sorry for laughing at that.
We are more than glad that you started watching New Who, because you have obviously started to watch Classic Who with all of your Hartnell reviews.
Yeah, and seriously, holy crap, you've turned into this massive super fan, this mega Whovian. So, Stephen, seriously, the stars were aligned. The cosmos was speaking through you. I am super pleased that you started watching the show.
If you want to read more about Stephen, you can follow him on Twitter. He is at sgamer82.
That's 82, the number. Stephen, Steve Meister, Steve Rooney, Stevie Gamer, thank you very much. Bing bong, Future Ponkin here. Just wanted to add a tiny little note to say that we received not one, but two more mini-reviews for this particular episode. In chronological order, the first one came from Gallifreyan Buccaneer, regular contributor to the show. How you doing, dude? Ladies and gentlemen, Gallifreyan Buccaneer sent in a spiffing review. However, it is a combined review of The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances. For that reason, we've included it in our next review, our next New Who review, that is. The follow-up to this one, The Doctor Dances. You get what I'm talking about. You're a clever person. It's in your nature. All of this basically is to say, Gallifreyan Buccaneer, Thanks for your review. You're a freaking spiffing hoobie, and don't worry, we haven't forgotten about you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you happen to be time travelers and you've already heard that mini review and you want to tell Gallifrey and Buccaneer what a fantastic mini it was, pop onto Twitter. Tell him there. While you do so, follow him. That's what I do. FYI, he's changed his Twitter handle. That's right. He is now at Alan Trussler. That's Trussler with two S's. The next mini review that we received comes from Holy Freaking Flashback Attack. It comes from Robert Albrecht. Holy moly! Our very first official German fan? Was it the officially first whatever? The very first Who Back When International shout-out recipient? The first... Yes, that's how you phrase it. The first official German fan of Who Back When. Rob, thank you very much. Rob has sent in the following mini. He says, the phone is ringing for the first time and Rose is hanging to a Zeppelin right in the middle of the London Blitz. Eccleston is fantastic and we see Jack for the first time. The scene where Jack shows Rose his psychic paper is very funny. And he adds to that, Captain Jack is fun, but his character needs more depth. Very interesting, Rob Meister. Care to elaborate? He goes on, this show is freaking scary, and I'm not sure if this is suitable for children. And he concludes, the production values are top-notch, 4.5 out of 5. That is a generous but fair mark. I can sense that there is a lot of energy behind this mini. Rob, thank you very much for sending this in. I love it. I was about to give you a Twitter shout-out, but it just occurs to me I'm not entirely sure if you're on Twitter. Do you have a Twitter handle? If so, ping me on Twitter. Okie dokie. Let's get back to past JD and Ponkin. Yeah? And tell them hi from me. Ciao. Holy crap. I can't wait. Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to have to travel a week ahead in time or maybe just check out our iTunes feed because we need to record the follow-up review.
So if you can't wait until next week, you can always get your fill by listening to some classic Who reviews or some audio Who reviews. You can
or some other new Who reviews.
Who Back When. We should be because we're doing them.
Yeah.
There's also audio and classic.
Yeah.
you can go to whobackwhen.com and see the latest reviews there. Check out the visual index. You can even follow us on Facebook, which is Facebook/whobackwhen.
All in one word.
You can go to SoundCloud and subscribe to us there.
Yeah, please do.
You can subscribe and rate on iTunes.
Oh my goodness, that would mean the world to us.
It even says so in our theme tune. you can go to other places such as Google Plus and Reddit. And if you wish to follow the whimsical stylings of Ponkin, you can follow him on Twitter. He is at Ponkin.
Damn right.
If you wish to follow me, you can follow me at Marius Kane.
That's Kane with a K.
And until next time,
we have
been Ponkin.
That's me. Thank you so much for listening.
And I've been JD.
And you've been great.
It's been wonderful. See you next time.
Ciao.
Who Back When?